So when did we first meet? I think you were like a major.
Yeah, I was at Makatea. I think that's when we first met. Yeah, yeah. Oh, it may have been briefly, right? Like,
you were
there
still during the EFE program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was OTPO at Makatea, and then I was the branch head.
Okay.
For amphibious systems, I guess we called it at the time, which included EFV.
Right.
So those were the days we would go up there, and that was like getting ready for the second OA.
Yep.
What did you do in the Marine Corps? I didn't realize you were you retired as what, a gunner or a master
sergeant?
So I didn't realize that until like listening to this podcast.
Yeah, so we're not going to use all this, but no, I was public affairs.
Okay, so you did the same thing.
I had 2 days left in boot camp, and they were like, this is a funny story, because they were like, okay, well, you and you, there's two of us, you go to the public affairs office, and I'm like, you know, and I'm at MCRD trying to figure out what the hell this is. Lo and behold, I'm going to school to be a TV broadcaster. Well, I spent all of 20 minutes in broadcast, and the Army says, you got a voice for newspaper. Apparently, I have a bad nasal
like a
tone.
Face radio, yeah. A voice for newspaper.
You know, 38, 39 years later, here I am. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Equipping the Corps. The ACV is the Corps' next-generation vehicle designed to move Marines from ship to shore. It is currently replacing the assault amphibious vehicle, which has served the Corps for more than 40 years. The ACV will be the primary means of tactical mobility and lethality for the Marine Battalion Landing Team embarked aboard the Marine Expeditionary Unit at sea and ashore. The ACV has the capability to provide organic direct fire support to dismounted infantry in the attack and has a sustained ground mobility similar to the M1A1 tank. The ACV will support expeditionary mobility, capability, and capacity with balanced levels of performance, protection, and payload. Currently leading this fielding and development efforts across all ACV mission role variants for the Marine Corps is a Marine acquisition professional with a few decades of experience, not only as a veteran assault amphibian officer, but a few different acquisition tours under his belt. Colonel Tim Howe. Colonel Howe, did I get that right? Assault amphibious... Amphibious assault.
Right.
So, before we get into the thicket of things here, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up here at in this acquisition world of ours?
Yeah. I'll make this quick. Certainly, I was commissioned in '98. Went to VMI. Graduated VMI. Really didn't have a lot going on. Thought about joining the Peace Corps, selling pharmaceuticals. Graduated without a plan and figured I needed to eat. So went to an OSO's office in Ashland, went to OCS, commissioned in December 98, got selected to be an Amtraker, and then went to 2nd Assault Amphibian Battalion, did the 22nd MEU as a lieutenant, B billet down at Parris Island, and then came back, was the Alpha Company commander, went over to OIF in 07 under RCT-6, running what we called AO Gator, which was MSR Mobile. It's kind of like 95 for about 15, 20 miles. And then from there, this is where I really kind of get into the acquisition piece. Came back, was the OPSO at 2nd Trex, and then went to a little place called Makatea, Marine Corps Operational Test and Evaluation Activity, which I know you're aware of. They do operational testing. They're an independent agency that just ensures that the gear we field is operationally effective and suitable so that when it gets in the hands of Marines, it works as intended. So given my AAV background, I did the operational testing for the Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle, which kind of brings everything full circle as to where I'm sitting now. Worked with PMAAA back then, working up to their second operational assessment before the program was ultimately...
Canceled.
There you go.
Terminated.
And that's why you're the public affairs, the head of OPAC here at Cisco.
Well, I remember those days because I was actually a member of that team. So
right.
I'm well versed on that date and everything. But anyway.
So while I was there, I was kind of getting, I had someone, my dad was in the Marine Corps, and we may or may not talk about that, but he is, you know, recommending, hey, why don't you get into acquisitions? I certainly was not. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go back. My dream was to be the battalion commander of 2nd A Battalion. But the kind of more I looked at it, I enjoyed doing it. It was fun. And the impact institutionally that you could have as an acquisition officer, I felt was far greater than I would ever have as a battalion commander. That's not to take away from what they do. But I just enjoyed the fact that I could have a kind of a, for lack of a better word, strategic impact on the Marine Corps with respect to the work you do as an acquisition officer. So I threw my hat in, got selected, and did a short fellowship at DARPA.
Okay.
Met my now wife there. She still works there. And then came here to SysCom. Started out as a project officer under a great guy who unfortunately passed away, Lieutenant Colonel Abagunran, DJ Abagunran. Yep. In optics, and then moved over to body armor, did some body armor work under Colonel Rob Bailey, another great mentor and leader, and then went up to DCGS, work in intel program, which I had no background in, but the great thing about being an acquisition officer is you can move all over. It's all cost, schedule, and performance and leadership.
Right.
Work for another great leader, Colonel Dave Burton.
Yeah.
And then got selected for school and being a PM at the same time. I don't know how that happened. I should have played the lottery. But went over to PMIW for about 30 days right after the FSR, the reorg here at SysCom, and then went to school for a year and then came back, was the PM for IW for 3 years, did some good work. Work for
infantry weapons.
Yeah,
no, that's
all
right.
We'll get all these acronyms.
We have a dictionary of acronyms that there, I refer to, but
put it in the show notes. Yeah. And then got selected for Colonel, and then got selected for PM AAA. Again, very fortunate to get selected for both of those, and then I sit here now in front of you.
So it's fascinating. I mean, you started as an Amtraker, and and I guess in some small way, here you are kind of full circle.
Yeah.
From where you started, and now you have the responsibility of actually fielding the future of the community.
Yeah.
So that's got to be kind of a great feeling.
It's
or
surreal.
Not.
No, it is. I mean, it's a lot of pressure. Yeah. And it's a lot of pressure because institutionally, the ACV is so critical in what we're about to do and what we're, you know, developing, you know, everything towards with respect to force design. So a lot of pressure. It's a lot of excitement, though. I mean, rising tide raises all boats. So it's helping at least me personally develop better as an officer and as an acquisition officer. But it is surreal. I think if you had told me and you know, whenever we did MOS selection in 1999 that I would now be a colonel in charge of fielding the new, you know, the replacement to the AAV, right. I would have called you a liar. So.
And I think the other thing that's really neat, too, is, you know, there are communities within this community of the Marine Corps. You know, there's the aviators and the grunts and all this, you know, and the AV community is no different. I mean, y'all are very close-knit community, and so it's a brotherhood within this brotherhood. So to speak. So
I
don't want to put any more pressure on you than you already have.
No, you know, you know, it is a niche capability, right? So within the aviator community, you know, the aviation community, excuse me, there's tribes within that.
Right.
For the Amtrak community, it is a unique niche that really is kind of imbued in the DNA of being a Marine, and that's coming from the sea. So I know Amtrakers take it very seriously, but I think sometimes we're looked at as kind of odd ducks too. So, but it's a great community.
I wasn't going to say that, but all I can say is they always got me where I needed to be.
That's
so
right.
I'm not going to complain.
That's right.
So,
that's right. But no, it's a great community. There's a lot of great people. And like any small tribe, there's a lot of kind of legends within that. And I've been fortunate to be the benefactor of having great staff and COs are kind of considered legends now, and great officers to have served next to, served with, and served under. So
that's actually a great segue. Can you tell us when you took over PM AAA, and if you would, just tell us a little bit about your team? I know it's broken down into
So I took over May 3rd of 2021. Jumped right in, and you know, COVID has kind of, it makes it difficult when you're taking a new organization over with you know, a global pandemic to get to know everybody. But I think we've tried everything to try to get in front of people and get to know them as much as possible. But the team that I have is fantastic. I mean,
how large is the group over there?
So we're about 150 contractor and government. And both our support contract and our government folks are fantastic. I know you know them well since you came from PM AAA and your former life at one point. And a lot of those folks are still at PM AAA, and that is a gem to have, at least as a PM, because there's a lot of institutional knowledge as to why decisions were made and how we got to here. And then also just dealing with big programs like the ACV, which is right now the largest ground acquisition program for the Marine Corps. So they have a good understanding of dealing with Headquarters Marine Corps, ASN RDA, some of the requirements that go in with that, and then how to deal with it. And it's just, and this is not to say that anybody at CISCOM is not. I'm speaking specifically at PM AAA, just a lot of professionals over there who are well-versed in acquisitions and all the nuances that go with a big program. So
absolutely.
A great team.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as you're aware and you mentioned, I mean, I had firsthand knowledge of the inner workings, and I don't want to call it the bureaucracy, but all the layers that you have to go through to ensure not only the management oversight, but the execution of an MDAP or a major defense acquisition program. Let's jump right into ACV. When did the Corps start fielding the ACVs?
Yeah, so we started fielding in first quarter of 2021. Okay. So, excuse me, 2020. Colonel Kirk Mullins, Chief of Staff now, was the PM then, did a fantastic job along with the PM to get the vehicle, certainly through IOT&E, to a full rate production decision, and then ultimately, into the first fielding of that first quarter of FY 2020. To date, we have fielded four platoons. So we field about 18 vehicles per quarter. Okay. So about a platoon per quarter.
Okay.
We're gearing up and working with BAE to field our fifth platoon here this quarter in February, March timeframe. And then we're going to focus on fielding to the 31st MEU in Okinawa in order to get them prepped to start deploying with the 31st MEU.
So platoon, is that approximately a MEU's worth of assets?
It is. So in the construct now, and what I think the way the ACV is kind of built out is it's built to support the seven MEUs, as well as in a AA battalion, you'll have a MEU company and a division support company. That's one for the MEU company to kind of, one's deployed, one's getting ready to deploy, and the other one's just returned and rearming and refitting. And then you've got the division support company that will, support division taskings, any contingencies that may arise. But within that construct, it's 18 vehicles per platoon in order to support that. And that doesn't account for the ACVC or the chase vehicles that go with that. Or the ACVR, which is part of the variance, which I think we'll talk about here during...
Yeah, and it's actually a great point, because I know you've been focused on the personnel variance for the most part. But can you tell us how many variants does the Marine Corps plan to have of this vehicle, and where are they at in their life cycle?
Yeah, so I think I was just having this conversation the other day. I think a lot of times it gets lost that people think the ACV program's in production, we're on our way, and life's hunky-dory. We're actually in all phases right now of the acquisition life cycle. We're in production and fielding of the ACVP, which is the personnel variant, carries 13 embarked troops as well as three crew. We are actually going to operational testing, the follow-on operational test and evaluation for the ACVC, which is the command and control variant, which accommodates seven embarked staff with the crew. That once that FOT&E is done, providing we're successful, which I don't have any concerns about, we'll go into production and start fielding the ACVC in FY23. The next variant in the hopper, that's we're actually going to a CDR, which is a critical design review, which will slap the table on the final design for the ACV-30, which is the gun variant, 30-millimeter cannon. We are in design and development, do the CDR in March. Once the CDR is complete, provided successful, then we'll be on our way with respect to continued design and development, and then ultimately get into testing, and then finish that out with production. And then the final one is the ACV recovery variant. We have a tech demonstrator we're working on out at Nevada Automotive Test Center in Carson City. You're well aware of that. We've both been there. And we're really burning down kind of risk as to what is in the realm of the possible for the ACVR. BAE is lockstep with us and working on that. They'll then take what we have, start the design and development. Okay. We'll go into a preliminary design review, critical design review, build some PRTVs, get into testing, and then rinse, repeat, and then get into production. And ultimate goal of fielding the ACVR in FY27 and FY28. Okay. So the strategy that was built, if I could real quick, it's pretty, you know, for a large program, when I stepped in, I was pleasantly surprised that the strategy that was developed and approved by then Secretary Gertz was the ACVP, the ACV family of vehicles is the program, and then each variant is an ECP. And that
an engineering change,
an engineering change proposal, which mitigated the need to kind of go back and kind of do new starts for each program.
So you saved yourself a lot of time.
Saved ourselves a lot of time in order to get the vehicles fielded, all variants fielded as quick as, you know, humanly possible. I think as far as a program, from the time this requirement was approved in 2015 to fielding in 2020, for a major, you know, program, that's pretty quick to get that done. And we were able to accomplish that by adopting, you know, the Iveco Centauro vehicle and then modifying it for our needs as a Marine Corps.
And building it here in the States, obviously.
Certainly, yeah. It's built out in New York, Pennsylvania. Okay.
So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, but all the gun enthusiasts out there probably want to know, what's the ACV gun variant? I mean, currently, I know you've done some evaluations of different systems, but you got a 50 cal, but you're not going with a 50 cal for a gun variant.
Well, so no, we're not for the gun variant. So the ACVP has a remote weapon station, which has, you know, you can either mount the 50 cal or the Mark 19 with plans to mount a Javelin in sometime in FY25. But the ACV-30, which is the gun variant, is a 30mm cannon. The turret is a Striker turret that we've modified in order to make it lighter, because certainly weight is a constraint when trying to swim in the water. And then the Kongsberg is developing the gun, the 30mm gun, in order to support the development of the ACV-30.
So I think it's kind of neat. You talk about the fact that when we're talking about the ACV family of vehicles and how you incorporated ECPs to change the vehicles out and cut down on your time, you just mentioned the fact that you're looking at a Striker variant turret, so you're really going out after what's best of breed, so to speak, making it a little bit better. And incorporating it for our purposes.
Yeah, and I think that's an important kind of...
Some cost savings built in there somewhere.
Well, and speed, right? So the Marine Corps, you know, certainly we had the AAV for, we're going on 50 years now, and been a great vehicle. When we went with the EFV, you know, that was supposed to be the replacement, right? That was, and it didn't work out. So the Marine Corps... institutionally had to find a replacement fairly quickly and get it out fairly quickly. And so found what's good enough, what's best of breed right now in order to get that out there, in order to replace the AAV and get something better than what we have. And I'm happy to report, just having been a company commander in Iraq, having been a lieutenant, watching the AAV and OIF, you know, we lost 5 vehicles as a company due to IEDs, what this vehicle is capable of doing, and certainly we're not going to be employing it in a counterinsurgency environment, at least I hope anytime soon. From a survivability standpoint, this vehicle is far better than what we had in the AAV. But the point I make is, institutionally, we had to get a replacement quick. We found an NDI. The strategy was, let's go find a non-developmental item. Let's see what's out there. You know, what's existing, let's modify it and get it out. And then as a family of vehicles construct, how can we lean out the schedule as quick, you know, as much as possible in order to get these different variants out as quick as possible.
I want to shift gears a little bit. I know the last year has been a difficult time for the AAV community due to the unfortunate training accident took the lives of 8 Marines and 1 sailor. I know both the Navy and the Marine Corps have conducted numerous investigations, not only for accountability,
But to also make sure that every lesson is learned and applied to prevent future tragedies, obviously. Can you tell us what steps your team has taken to assist the fleet in this effort, your involvement in some of this?
Well, so first, you know, what happened in July of 2020 was certainly a travesty. You know, and being an Amtraker, it breaks my heart. It really does. So now as a PM, you know, I still have, you know, that Amtraker heritage inside me. And so not that any other PM would do differently, but right. Everything that we do is geared towards how can we make this better? How can we get better and how can we learn from this? Not just as a program office, right? Like, so in my capacity as a program manager for AAA and being an Amtraker, I'm one of two colonels in the entire community. So my ability to influence the battalions is not as great as Colonel John Medeiros is at the AAS, but working with the battalions and they are all on board, we're all in lockstep as far as we've got to get this right, we've got to learn from the past. We are hyper-focused on being the most proficient and being the most aware of any safety issues and calling those out when necessary as it relates to waterborne operations. So what have we done as a program office? A couple things. So PP&O has, you know, they released some guidance with respect to what is required before you can embark on an ACV as it gets into the water. And that includes a current swim qual and current SVET or submersible vehicle egress trainer certification is necessary before you can get on the vehicle. From a material standpoint, we have fielded the WEC, the waterborne egress capability, which includes the LPU-41 and the submersible egress breathing device. Along with emergency egress lighting system, which EELS. So if water raises and hits a sensor, it'll display or it'll light up lights inside the vehicle. And then finally, we're actually working with BAE right now to do an engineering change proposal to the software on the ACV that if the bilge pumps are running longer than 30 seconds, it'll alert the driver so they can look. On top of that, we've developed trigger lines that trigger lines that will mandate when you have to evacuate out of the vehicle.
Right.
And those will be clearly briefed, clearly known. And then finally, different from the AAV, the ACV can accommodate a crew of 13. In the back, you know, whether it be the infantry community, will be a rear egress operator. That will be a trained Marine. So if an AAV platoon is attached to an infantry company, that'll be an infantry Marine who is trained to look for whether it be water or you know, any type of issues in the back, and then notify that vehicle commander. They'll be well versed on what those mandatory trigger lines are and when to evacuate. So those are some of the areas that we've been working on in order to improve upon the waterborne survivability of the ACV, as well as the Marines embarked on it. On top of that, the ACV has less water intrusion points than the AAV, so there's no more plenums on the ACV. There's two less hole plug openings on the bottom, and the ACV is just infinitely self-rideable. So if it were to turn over, it would turn back over on its own. So.
I know the Commandant made the decisions to no longer use AAVs in the water, except obviously humanitarian efforts and whatnot. Has that impacted on you and the program on how fast we field ACVs? Or are you comfortable with your schedule and where you're headed?
Yeah, so that's been a pretty popular topic lately with respect to, okay, if now that we've made this decision, what's the impact not only to divestment, but also the ACV fielding? Right now, we're just based upon BAE's capacity at York to produce the vehicle. There's just it doesn't make sense, and nor is it really possible at this point to increase, you know, in any quantifiable number, the number of ACVs that we can build.
But I think it's fair to say you're at a good place right now.
We are.
I mean, of the seven Mews, you've already outfitted close to five, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, we've outfitted five platoons. We're about to outfit the fifth platoon. Okay. So we're well on our way to, you know, we're just getting into kind of the real meat of fielding out the entire community. We won't be fielding any faster than what's planned. There are discussions right now as to where we field may change based upon that decision.
Right, right. Now, I know there was a towing problem that mm-hmm. impacted the ACVs, I believe, a couple of months ago. But I think there's a y'all have figured out the fix and whatnot. Can you give us a little overview of what happened and where you are right now?
Yep. This was something, the CTOW quick release on the vehicle didn't operate as intended. Despite not seeing this issue in testing, you give a bowling ball to a Marine, he'll give you two back. So they discover things that we would have never have seen. And so fortunately,
but not an uncommon thing for you, not mm-hmm. an uncommon thing for the program office to feel the capability.
And then all of a sudden, and I think that's,
hey, that hook doesn't work the way it's supposed to. I got to put something else there. So.
Yeah, certainly. So I think anytime you field a new piece of equipment, Marines are going to find a better way to do it. Right. And that a PM shop has to be postured to answer that. And answer it as quick as possible, depending upon the criticality of it. With the CTOW quick release, that was a critical fix that we had to get done in the near term. Because the Marine Corps and the PM shop, as well as PEO Land Systems and Marine Corps Systems Command, take safety in a waterborne vehicle like the ACV that we take it so seriously that we put out a deadline safety of use message initially. Mm-hmm. In order to kind of just pump the brakes, let's figure out what's going on. And really what happened was the CTOW quick release, based upon the rope that was fielded with the vehicle, the rope didn't have enough elasticity to support the dynamic loading. And then I'm going to get kind of geeky on you here. As it went through the surf zone, it's an art to tow a vehicle through the surf zone. There's a lot of wave action, which creates a lot of back and forth with each vehicle, which creates a lot of loads. The rope that we had fielded with the vehicle didn't have any elasticity to support that. Which was causing deformation of the CTOW quick release. And once it started deforming, the vehicles would just release on their own. Now the towed vehicle is stranded, or could be stranded in the water. Right. It's on its own. So we initially released a deadline safety of use message to figure it out. And then we realized, we can allow Marines to just train in the boat basin at Del Mar in protected waters. So long as they had a safety boat with them. Right. And there were, based on how the Del Mar boat basin is constructed, there's egress points very close by. So over the last 3 months, we did a pretty in-depth root cause analysis to figure out what the problem was. We identified the ropes as the issue, and I'm happy to report we just started fielding the new ropes, tow rope construct. It wasn't the CTOW quick release. It was just a choice of the ropes. And we've been working with the fleet fielding those, and we have 12 sets 12 vehicles worth this week, and we'll be fielding the remaining vehicles that are at the fleet right now by April, and then we'll just cut those new ropes into production so that each new rope shows up, or each new vehicle shows up with the right ropes. On top of that, we did not want Marines to get training on an old system during new equipment training. So and because we put the SUM, they weren't allowed to go in the open ocean. Marines who are going through new equipment training with the ACV were not allowed to get that open ocean training. So they received a restricted license. And part of the conditions as far as going back in the open ocean is you must have new tow ropes. You must have training on the new tow ropes. And then any Marine who received a restricted license because they weren't allowed to go out in the open ocean and get that period of instruction must then go back and get that open ocean training so that we're confident as a PM shop that Marines are trained the right way before they go out in the open ocean and conduct any amphibious training. We'll be doing that in February with those Marines to make that up so they can get an unrestricted license. And this is all because we take this so seriously that we don't want to let Marines not receive the right training and have the right amount of, or the right kit in order to go out in the open ocean. Third Tracks just did their own training with the ropes and no issues. So we continue to field.
Well, and I got to tell you, you got very technical on the rope. But as somebody who a few weeks ago lived through the big snowstorm that stranded lots of us, I personally had some experience doing a little towing and getting vehicles out of a ditch. And I got to tell you, you have to have the right equipment, and you can't just put a, you know, a rope is a rope is a rope. And unfortunately, it's not. So
And you would think so, right? You would think, wow, it's a rope. What's the big deal? Yeah. And I think
handles 100,000 pounds. I'm good to go, right?
Right. No. And what you find is it does matter, you know, and every little thing matters. So.
No, that's fascinating. Really appreciate that insight. Change gears a little bit. As with any major acquisition effort, we rely obviously on our industry partners to feel the capabilities we need to get it into the hands of Marines. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with BAE and their role in getting us to where we are today?
Yeah, certainly. So as you mentioned, BAE is is the prime for the ACV. Quick background on BAE. The original AAV was built by the Food Machinery Corporation.
Right.
BAE bought FMC. And so BAE has been the producer of the AAV and now the ACV for years. And it's kind of in their heritage. So they've been a long-standing partner. Our relationship's good with them. We just finished up a major contract award with BAE to get through what we call lots 2 through 4. That will round out production of the ACVP and the ACVC. And they've been, they have their challenges with COVID, with supply chain. The preponderance of the ACV, about 62%, is made by an Italian company called Iveco.
Right.
So from a global supply chain perspective with a pandemic, they've had to work through some challenges. But they work hard, and they have the same focus that we do, and that's getting capability out to Marines, and making sure that it works. So our relationship's good. I got a good relationship with my counterpart, and in fact, that's where I was right before here. We were at one of our monthly PMRs to kind of sync up and figure out what our challenges are and how to fix them.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't say it's not just BAE. BAE's got a lot of companies they work with, or a lot of companies that are in contract to them.
Yep.
But there are others out there. So for our friends in industry who might be listening, what, if anything, should they be focused on that may support, both of these programs going forward? I guess the remainder of the life of the AAV or the ACV, anything in particular?
So the ARV is the Advanced Reconnaissance Vehicle. It's a possible replacement to the LAV. Marine Corps right now is looking at, do they want a new start or do they want to use the existing platform of the ACV? Other opportunities like organic precision fires integrated into the ACV, something that's discussed. But as of right now, we are focused on the 4 variants in the family of vehicles.
So I think you just answered my next question, but I was going to just pose this to you. What's next for ACV?
Yeah.
So, the question is after your statement, but...
Yeah. So what's next is just focusing on the family of vehicles. As I mentioned at the very start of this, we're in all phases of the acquisition life cycle. So, continue working production of the P, go through operational testing of the ACVC, and then continue the design and development of the last 2 variants of the ACV-30 and the ACVR.
Awesome. Well, listen, a lot of great information. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and kind of walking us through some of this. But before I get to what many claim is my favorite segment of the show, I do want to put you on the spot for a second. I'd be remiss if I didn't brag a little bit about not only the Marine, but also Tim Howe, proud dad and family man. I met your family at your promotion. It was an honor to meet your family. I was truly impressed by their presence, the outpouring of love and support that you got there. I know the Howe family has a long history of service to our Corps, our country, and that tradition continues to this day. So I gotta ask you, what's your secret balancing all of this? I know you got a son that's in the Corps, if I'm not mistaken.
I do. It's a lot of energy drinks.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
You met your wife at DARPA. You know.
Yeah, no, so I'm a... Man, it goes back a long way. So my dad, helped... I've got big shoes to fill, certainly.
I wasn't going to bring that up.
Yeah, I know. And I generally don't because I try to protect his reputation. Yeah. And so he certainly had a big hand in me coming into the acquisition community. He helped kind of found this MOS. And you know, he had a longstanding history in acquisition. So, you know, when people ask, I'm not ashamed to talk about it. Right, I don't generally offer it up just because, you know, I'm here to make my own name. But so between him and I've had three cousins, a brother-in-law, all in the Marine Corps, and then, you know, my immediate family.
Almost fill out your own platoon.
I could. So my own, in fact, I've got a cousin right here in the command that a lot of people don't know about. He's a project officer over in Intel. So, how do I do it? I really, truly value like work-life balance. And it's something I try to impress upon, you know, every organization I've had the honor of being in charge of is, hey, look, you know, work-life balance is important. It's on that person to figure out where to kind of make that choice of when family's important, when work is important. But, you know, at the end of the day, as much as I value and honor being a Marine, what's most important is my family being around me kind of when I take that last breath. So I try to balance it all. And you know, my wife does a great job. As I mentioned, I met her at DARPA. She's my biggest fan. So also the first one to tell me when I'm screwing up, which is a lot of times. But, you know, so it's just...
I resemble that comment.
That's right. Yeah. So, and then, like I said, my son's an air traffic controller. He's a corporal supremely. In fact, he's going to pick up sergeant, I think, here next month. So I'm overwhelmingly proud of what he's done. And then I've got three daughters and then a son. And I'm fortunate I've got good kids. Yeah. You know, I don't have to... Aside from your normal teenage stuff, you know, I don't have to worry about my kids, and they're all just good kids. So,
and you're still living through some of those teenage years yours, so.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't normally go down this road, but I do have to tell you, like I said, I met your family
during your
promotion, and it was really a pleasure to see the outpouring of love and support that existed there. So kudos to you.
I appreciate it.
I know, obviously, I'm maybe a little biased because I've followed your career a little bit. Our paths have crossed a little bit. So
I got a lot of help in there, too. My mom lives close by. I mean, I grew up in Stafford County. Yeah. Not a lot of people can say that. I don't think a lot of people claim Stafford County. But I've got a great family, and I do appreciate that. It means a lot to hear. Like I said, I've got a good support cast around me. So.
Well, listen, again, I'm gonna tell you, thanks so much for taking the time for joining us here, Colonel Howe. But before I let you go...
There we go. This is my favorite part.
There's one more thing I got to do. It's our lightning round.
I've been prepping for this.
All right. Let me see. Let me see how many you missed.
I've been thinking about this more than anything else on this podcast.
All right. Let's do it. And I hope you're ready.
I am ready.
And the first one, and if you tell me Stafford, what's your favorite duty station?
Camp Lejeune, North Carolina.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought for sure you were going to say the West Coast, but
I've never been stationed on the West Coast. Platoon commander, company commander at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. It's God's country. Life is slow, and absolutely love it.
I won't let the secret out of the bag, but I just bought a property not too well, a little ways from there, but it's in that general neck of the woods, so I can relate a little bit. All right. What's a TV show, book, movie, or a podcast you'd recommend?
This one, of course.
Well, thank you.
I will promote this podcast, and the Marine Corps Gazette has Scuttlebutt. That's another great podcast that's kicked off. Vic Rubel.
I know you've been on there a time or so.
Yeah, it's a shameless plug. So books, I've thought long and hard about, so I'll recommend three books. Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, very good book, kind of a dive into Stoicism. It's just a great book on how to kind of live life. The next one is Endurance about Ernest Shackleton. It's a great book about leadership. They got went to go traverse the South Pole right before World War One.
World War One kicks
off. They get stuck in pack ice.
Yeah.
No one remembers him, and he led every single member of his team out of there some pretty heroic feats he had to pull off to save everybody after being stuck there for, you know, almost 3 years. So, and then the third one is called Orbiting the Giant Hairball. And so, yeah.
Not familiar with that one. Yeah. I know number two. I actually read number two many years ago.
The third one, Orbiting the Giant Hairball, is just basically how to kind of avoid bureaucracy. And it's kind of, when you read it, it's almost like this guy's notes and doodles. But really how to pull yourself out of bureaucracy and kind of get things done quickly. So
I may have to take the book part out of there because my producer keeps taking notes on all the books that people want, and then she wants me to
read them all.
So I got to tell Kelly to stop sending me all these books. But no, that's great feedback. If you weren't doing what you're doing now, what would you be doing?
Man, yeah.
What would Tim be out there doing?
What would Tim Howell be doing?
Yeah.
You know, I've always wanted to be a teacher. But if
careful what you ask for, because there's a great need for them right now.
Yeah, absolutely. anything outdoors actually would be the other one, right? I would love to be like a park ranger or just, you know, working outdoors. I think would be fun and having the opportunity to engage with people. I just like being around people.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And finally, one of my favorites. If you could have any superpower,
yeah,
what would it be?
Man, I've thought about this. Everybody is like, you know, I'm gonna throw a twist on the time piece. If I could stop time. Not time travel.
Okay.
If I could just stop time and then start it when I want, right? So, you know, if I get everybody to just kind of stop, I can do what I need to do and then hit start and everything is right where I stopped it at would be great.
You know, that would have been helpful during the big blizzard of 95 just a few weeks ago
where
we could have kept everybody off of 95 before
absolutely.
That disaster.
Absolutely.
Now, listen, Colonel Tim Howe, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I appreciate
really
it.
Appreciate you taking the time and best of luck with all the endeavors and and continued success to you and the ACV team.
I appreciate that. I really do. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, this concludes another episode of Equipping the Corps. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation today. If so, please take a couple minutes, leave us a review, subscribe, tell your friends about us. Till next time, Manny Pacheco signing off.